You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Today we are finally able to pick up on one of the biggest loose ends in recent cinema and our podcast history, the new Bond, No Time to Die, which has hit the big screen with a 2-year delay and a whopping 6-year gap since the last outing, Spectre. No Time to Die is notably Daniel Craig's swan song as James Bond, and what a way to go it is, enthralling many and enraging some. And this is the moment to probably give our spoiler warning. We will spare no plot twist and surprise ending here and cut straight to the chase. So if you haven't seen No Time to Die yet, come back to us later. Now to discuss the 25th 007 entry are once more my fellow Bond baristas, Julie and Alan. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
And hi, Alan.
Hello.
So here's our take on Daniel Craig's blockbuster farewell in No Time to Die. And our regular listeners might remember the episode in which we discussed the world of Bond and our favorites and least favorites. So as a starter, I'll ask you two right off the bat, Julie and Alan, how did you approach the new Bond? And how was the experience of the first true pandemic blockbuster?
Well, it is basically a blockbuster, right? And we've been gagging for one. We've been jonesing to go to the cinema with big sounds, big noises, big action, car chases and the whole shebang. So that's how I approached it. It was my one coming out of the pandemic big blockbuster. And this is because I don't usually go to mainstream films in the multiplex, only if it's something special. And I think as it was like nearly sold out every single showing of every single day, I was not the only one who felt like, let's go out with an end of pandemic with a bang.
And how did you approach it, Alan?
I mean, as probably this group's self-declared Bond skeptic, knowing that I was going to record this, I very much used it as an excuse to finally watch Spectre. So I hadn't seen that. And there was an element of sort of like, that's a bad film, in my opinion. And it lowered expectations enough that I enjoyed this more. I sort of got to the end of Spectre and I was a bit sort of shrugging shoulders and not sure about. And then No Time to Die, I think if you go in with low expectations, I enjoyed it a lot more. I was fearing the worst and I enjoyed it because of, you know, go in with low expectations, you won't be disappointed and you'll probably be entertained. And it's better than Spectre.
So we're basically opposites, Alan, because of course I went in with the highest expectations, having been a Bond fan for many, many years and having had to wait for such a long time, but with a difference. This time I did not really read up on any plot details. I tried to really keep it away, and they did a good job of keeping stuff secret, obviously, but I really didn't read any reviews, anything online in the last couple of weeks since it was out. So I was super excited, super hyped, and I must say, also really liked it. So that's an interesting triple perspective. So let's go straight into it. What was there to enjoy, Alan? And especially if we talk about the difference from Spectre, the new movie obviously is a continuation of many of the elements started there. What did you particularly enjoy?
I mean, following on from what Julie said, there is just something lovely about seeing the big film on the big screen that delivers action. And I think especially coming out of pandemic, it's just nice to have that. It's nice to be in a position to just enjoy a huge cinema. I mean, I booked a ticket to go see this on an IMAX screen. I just thought if I'm going blockbuster, I'm going all the way in. So it was on a huge screen. And yeah, that sort of really sort of, you don't want to be sort of snobby about that kind of film. That kind of film entertains in itself. And I think for that kind of film, it's a really solid, entertaining blockbuster. And it has more of a plot than it needs, but the plot is interesting. It kept me engaged. I was really surprised that I didn't feel the length of the film. Going in, thinking it was down as, you know, this is a really long Bond film. And I was kind of thinking, oh, you know, 2/3 of the way through, I'm going to be like, looking at my watch thinking, oh, not another explosion. Can we get to the end of this? But actually, there's enough of a story in it that it really kept me engaged to the end. And, which is pretty rare for a Bond film, I didn't see all the twists and turns in the story. So I was engaged on a level with characters and thinking, I don't know where they're going to go with these characters. I don't know what's going to happen next. And so it suddenly felt a lot more enthralling way compared to other Bond films, where the moment a character is introduced, you know basically who they are and what's going to happen to them. And it doesn't ever, it'll never quite surprise you. They'll be supporting characters, and they're only ever supporting characters. You'll never really care for them. And if they're introduced early on, they'll probably get killed by the villain. And if they're introduced late on, they might be lucky enough to survive to get into bed with Bond. But that's all the story you'll get for them. And this one, actually, I did get sort of with the good guys and the supporting cast of good characters, I got very sort of engaged in the story.
I must say that was also one of the main elements that surprised me, to see a Bond that was actually suspenseful and that didn't give me all the information already at the beginning and wasn't foreseeable. And I also felt it had many elements of horror cinema as well, which I thought was really enjoyable. It starts off as this Halloween-like opening, and I wasn't expecting that. I was taken aback from the very beginning, and then it put me on the edge of my seat in a way that I haven't seen in Bond yet. And then later on as well, there are many tropes that I would say are more closely connected to what we'd expect of a psycho thriller. There's a bit of Hannibal Lecter in it, obviously, and a bit of imitation of some of these cliches, but it worked out well, I thought. It was really a suspenseful evening at the cinema, and I was literally on the edge of my seat for most of it, especially then because I didn't know how it would turn out. And big spoiler, maybe sooner or later, but there, the turnout at the end, the big twist at the end, really came as a surprise. It could have gone either way, but Bond doesn't survive. Let's spell it out. So that I really enjoyed about it, that I didn't know what I was supposed to expect. Was it the same for you, Julie? What did you most enjoy?
I did feel the length, rather. I thought the last act in particular dragged a bit. And to me, the big, big twist at the end, where Bond goes out in a blaze of glory, was kind of inevitable, seeing what they dragged into the plot. So for me, especially the last part, I was sort of fidgeting a little bit. But I have to say, with that, the first two acts were probably, well, for reasons that we will certainly get to, one of my favorite in the Bondverse. They were wonderfully done. They were cleverly done. They were well thought out. Well, mostly, not all of it, but mostly. The characters were nice and three-dimensional. I hope we can go into the Ana de Armas bit where she's like totally not into Bond at all, which I really, really almost applauded out loud right there. There's the Bond girl who says, ew, you know, lovely. So it's all those sorts of bits. There's also a wonderful little scene with Q that I just adored. So I was in all the way up until the last act, and then I was starting to fidget in my seat and go like, okay, guys, we know where this is going. Get on with it. So that was, but on the whole, it's really well done, isn't it? It is well done, and it is well thought out. So on the whole, I think it's a very, very good film.
Absolutely. And as a Bond fan, I must say it was really also rewarding to see that balance they struck between pleasing the Bond crowd with these typical Bondian moments. And you mentioned the Cuba scene, of course, with Ana de Armas, which is just prime example Bond, just a little scene that could stand on its own in a way. And at the same time, they were telling a story, like you said, Alan, that was meaningful. There was a lot at stake. And I thought it was also exciting, as we said, you didn't know what was expecting you. I was thinking back of the podcast we did on different Bond movies, on the world of Bond as a whole. And I think there was one thing that reminded me, Julie, we also said that in other Bond films, for instance, the very popular Skyfall, there's also this third act problem. And I was wondering, Alan, was that similar for you? Was there also this typical third act problem in No Time to Die?
I think what I found interesting with the third act here is when it's when it goes the most traditionally Bond. So we're suddenly on the sort of almost disused volcano lair. It's only then we really meet the villain, who is the pantomime Bond villain of the story. You've got Bond sneaking into a base, taking out guards. It's old school Bond lair action. And that, I think, I found quite interesting as a fun pantomime of Bond, but it does feel quite odd tacked onto the first couple of acts. What I found quite interesting, and again, this is someone who probably isn't a Bond fan, is that in making this film, I think they've gone a weird way with the character. And I don't know whether Bond fans are entirely happy with this, in the sense that how do we move the story on? Well, we'll give the character of Bond more depth. We'll give more story to him. But we're going to keep the pantomime elements of the villain and the underground volcano base. And often I felt the impression I got was I think Bond fans often want the character to be the same. They still want the sort of suave, sophisticated womanizer, but they wanted a different type of story. So that the story itself would be something very different, would be something very different in the world of action, adventure, and espionage. And the third act seemed to do this weird thing where they'd set up quite a different nature of Bond story, and especially a nature of Bond himself, but then gone, but we'd better give you the volcano lair, and we'd better give you sneaking around with loads of faceless people who are following the villain for reasons you can't quite understand. You know, plants that kill, and secret doors and secret exits, and let's get out before this place destroys, you know, the countdown for it to being destroyed. All the sort of cliches, they're in there, which I thought was quite interesting that they're still using those, even though they're aspiring to do something very different with the character of Bond himself.
Yeah, I noted that as well. I even wrote that down in not an irritation, but as a sort of sigh, is you can't be prayer book devout about the Bond script and then be an iconoclast at the same time. So this goes back to the third act where I'm like, exactly as Alan indicates, you have the Dr. No Island. You don't have Britt Eklund's bum, but it's close enough with a strange poisoned garden. And then you have this really iconoclastic ending where like somebody who's basically unkillable, you blow him up. And I was like, yeah, but that lacks impact. If you're going to be that devout to the Bond, let's say, formula, then it's going to lack impact to have that ending, because people are just going to be like, huh? And not, despite Daniel Craig's acting chops, and they are incredibly, incredibly well done in this, but it just lacks impact because you don't know what to feel about it, was kind of my, and it's supposed to be this big thing, right? And I was like, oh, there has to be a post-credit sequence, almost. I mean, am I the only one who feels like this?
No, even as a Bond fan, I felt there they were really fully going Dr. No. But it has to do with the writing process. There were a lot of different authors involved. Apparently, at one point, Rami Malek was supposed to be a kind of Dr. No reincarnation, and they dropped that, or it fell out of the script. So here, really, I felt they were trying to give this Bond finale, typical island scene, and link it to the story they had built up before. And I also thought this was the part that worked the least, because we were invested in Bond's personal story. And that's the other big plot spoiler here, to say Bond has a family, he has a daughter, he wants to spend time with them afterwards. It's about making a happy ending possible. And somehow Rami Malek is still there, and obviously he stands in the way of that. He has this DNA weapon, but Bond in a way goes also for personal reasons. He wants to save Madeleine and the girl Mathilde from the island. And in a way, I felt that was what I was invested in. And then the whole bit about these people on this island, what they were doing, and also didn't get what Rami Malek exactly was doing afterwards with that weapon, what he was supposed to sell and to whom. That was all a bit confusing. And I thought this was a mismatch. They had built an exciting story that I was personally invested in because of Bond as a character. And the rest was somehow just to have obstacles on the way there. And then, of course, creating the biggest obstacle of all, that Bond wasn't able to leave at the end. And but again, I was invested in Bond's fate and not, in a way, the world's fate because of the villain, his plan, and his lair and the people involved. So I thought that was a strange decision to write it that way. But as you said, maybe they were just trying to please all kinds of people at the same time. And in the end, it didn't work out so well as in the first two thirds.
Which I think is interesting, because the final third is to some extent the most traditional Bond. And, you know, if that's not sort of pleasing people, it does sort of say, like, you know, maybe let's like jettison that. I mean, I think the weakest thing in this, which again goes back to traditional Bond elements, is the villain. I think the villain in this was just not very interesting. The plan wasn't interesting. I thought the performance was incredibly hard. It was someone having like, oh, I play a Bond villain. I don't have to do much depth. I'll just pretend to be a lunatic and enunciate everything very poshly. And it really just, I've seen it before. It wasn't doing anything new with it. And there's the sequence where he's basically threatening Bond's child, which is straight out of almost satire of Bond, or it's pantomime. It's the villains threatening a child. And it fits the Bond universe, but at no point did it feel like this is a real morally evil antagonist that exists, who is doing this as a play in a story about character and their motivation. It was the cartoon villain doing an evil thing. And I think that I do wonder whether, you know, the villain not appearing till the third act effectively to some extent means they knew that this was a problem. So let's keep it out of the bit of the story we're taking seriously and then sort of drop him at the end as sort of like, you know, the cartoon bad guy in his lair. But I found that really disappointing.
And some people were juxtaposing this scene with scenes from Austin Powers. You know, Dr. Evil doing his bit, and there were really similarities even in the dialogue. It was really out of a Bond parody, more likely than a good serious Bond movie.
Yeah, it reminded me of a kid's book, where you have these children's books where you have these two-dimensional villains who only serve to just be wicked and have no particular backstory or anything interesting, but they're just there to be bad.
But he has an impact. He kills Bond in the end. And some people felt that was undeserved. And just to say about, you know, the Bond fandom and how they reacted to the film, there's very different reactions. There was very, very strong disappointment, obviously, in that decision to kill off Bond. And as you said, also by a villain that was just seen as weak. He didn't deserve to do that, many argued. And yeah, there's a bit of controversy going on if that was really what they were allowed to do to the Bond character, to have him killed. Maybe that gives us a chance to talk about not just the ending, but of course also this is the ending of Daniel Craig's tenure as Bond.
Yeah.
His fifth movie, and definitely one that will be remembered just for that, but also because it closes this chapter on a series of Bond films that were connected. There was a series of characters and plot elements that were taken into five different movies, which was new for the Bond universe, or mostly new. There were just bits and pieces that had been referenced before. How did you feel in terms of No Time to Die as a closure to Daniel Craig's tenure as Bond?
Full disclosure, I'm pretty biased. I mean, I've known Daniel Craig before he was Bond, way before, back from a film called Love is the Devil, as when he was basically an indie actor. So when he became Bond, and he was like dissed before being too blonde for Bond and so on, I was applauding because I was like, they're getting a character actor to play Bond. That means something about where they're taking this. If they're getting a character actor and not a model or an action person, they're going in for the characterization and for some of the complexities of the character, right? And that's what, to my mind, what Craig's job was. And this last film, and this is why I enjoyed so much of it right up until the ending that I thought was a bit dodgy, is that Craig is just awesome in this. He gets to do what he does best. He gets to have these melancholy, blue, unbelieving eyes staring into the face of his lover who may have betrayed him, all that sort of stuff. And he's marvelous in it with his ears and his craggy face, and it's just gorgeous. I thought he was intensely good in this. I really did. So as for giving him the chance to do his Bond his way, I thought it was an honorable ending of this cycle, which started very intensely with Casino Royale and the torture scenes and sort of the whole dark thing. And they now give him the time and the opportunity to act out some of this stuff. And I know he gets a little bit hammy every once in a while, but I think he's deserved it after all these films and breaking legs and all these sorts of injuries. He gets to ham a tiny little bit. So I thought, as the ending of the Craig cycle, it was a worthy ending, in as much as they let him just be the actor that he is in this really lovely role.
Now, Alan is a self-declared non-Bond enthusiast. What did you think of this closure of Daniel Craig's tenure?
I mean, I really like the fact he died. That's not an attack on him. I think it was a really interesting twist at the end. I think the strength of this film is that it tries to build this idea that Bond cares about people, that Bond has developed an attachment, that Bond is now a father. And that lives or dies as an audience caring about that, about how good Bond is, how good Bond is at selling it. You know, the realization that the woman he loved probably didn't betray him and that he wronged her. And then the realization that after that there is a kid. that lives or dies if you've got a good actor that can emotionally sell it. And I think Daniel Craig is really good at selling that. He's really good at selling that when there isn't that much dialogue about it. You don't have much time. You don't have nice long scenes by the kitchen sink where they talk about family drama. Daniel Craig's got to do it while he's effectively attacking a volcano lair. And I think it's testament to how good he is that he really does. I was really engaged with his story as a family saga. And I think it's interesting that it ends with his death. And that was quite a sort of satisfying payoff. I did have a slight feeling, and I wonder whether this was something they were keeping the door open as filmmakers or whether I've just been ruined by watching other films, that you have this sort of little story where he picks up his daughter's favorite cuddly toy that's been left. And I wondered whether there would be a post-credit sequence where we would find that she'd come home and there would be the cuddly toy.
Mm-hmm.
So a little send-off that suggests he might have lived. And I was sort of expecting that, just having seen a lot of films before and that's how they do things. And I thought it was quite interesting that that was absent. So they always say, you know, it's a death. Is it really a death if you don't see the body? I mean, in this, you don't really. I mean, it's properly vaporized. But I think right to the end of the end credits and the lights went up in the cinema, I was still thinking they're gonna row back on this slightly. They're gonna hint that he's still out there. That some,
yeah.
And I am quite glad they didn't. I think it's an interesting take to go, this take on the character is dead. There will be a new take on the character, but it won't be a follow-on. And I do wonder whether this is now the shape of the Bond universe going forward, whereas before you had this idea that they were changing the actor, but it was the same person. And it was the same person in the early 60s as it was in the, you know, even into the 90s, that this is the same agent who somehow is not aging in this universe. Whether you now go the route to say, when we cast a new actor, it's a restart of the Bond story and we're going to do something different. And we're going to be telling stories across the films until they choose to leave, at which point probably they will sell it as this is so-and-so's last film. Do you want to see if this take on Bond gets out alive?
But isn't that a bit Doctor Who?
I mean, it's, you can only do it two different ways, I think, with Bond. You either do the thing where you pretend that nothing has changed. And I know in comics, they've got the idea of what's called the Eternal Now, that you don't pretend, you know, if characters have a backstory as a soldier, the war they're a soldier in changes because a character introduced in the 60s who had fought in the Korean War is now the same age, so has to have fought in Afghanistan. And so they never openly acknowledge that it's odd that this character that was a young agent in the 60s is now a young agent in 2020, whatever. They sort of pretend that you have to ignore that you have to just go, just pretend it isn't there. It's all set in the Eternal Now. Time doesn't work like that. And so I think they did that for most of the Bond run. It really sort of played. But whether you can keep doing that, I don't know. Especially if you want people to take the story seriously. If you want to say this is a credible human relationship. Oh, by the way, one of them is James Bond. He's been around since the 60s and he doesn't age. I think you've immediately set up the fact that, you know, this relationship isn't going to last. It's going to be like a comic book supporting character. They will be in, but they will have to go because the status quo doesn't change. I think this allows them to say, well, there isn't a set status quo. There is a story that will get to an end with this character. I mean, the parallel with Doctor Who is always just on the level of recasting. But I think it is almost moving away from Doctor Who rather than saying it's recasting, but it's the same person. Aside from time, it's now saying, because we're recasting, we're going to have to basically reboot the universe because it doesn't make sense to have someone who looks different, who seems to be a bit younger, for us to still pretend it's the same person.
And I must say, even as a Bond diehard fan, I was not bothered by Bond dying. I was not of that camp that is now up in arms online, you know, creating videos saying it was the worst movie of them all because they killed James Bond. I think looking at the Bond series, there were so many unlogical decisions of bringing back characters, bringing back actors, actresses that had already been in Bond that were now reappearing. People didn't care about the seriality of Bond before. And of course, we're in a different age. There's much more focus on that. And it's nice that we have this self-contained Craig universe of Bond films now, but it's over, and I'm pretty sure that in a year or two they will decide on a new course to go. There'll be a new actor cast. Apparently it's not going to be a female James Bond, but some are speculating whether it's going to be just the 007, no longer a James Bond. That's one of the things that I've read. But I will not be bothered by that.
On that point, though, on the point of whether it will be a 007, I thought it was very interesting that at the very end, having stayed to the end of the credits, it was James Bond will return.
Yep.
Yes.
It wasn't 007 will return.
I was there until the very end.
We also stayed for the same reason Alan did, until after the credits, because we were so convinced there's going to have to be a post-credit Nick Fury-type reemergence. And then it just said, James Bond will be back. And I remember a tweet that was sent into the world by a fan who said, yeah, but how? Right? If 007 were to be back, that was foreshadowed by a scene in the film itself, where the 007 number gets switched around between agents. But that's not what it says. That's absolutely, Alan is absolutely right.
And that possibly gives us a good chance now to talk about also that 007 appearing in some of the other characters, because I thought that was really interesting and might be also a direction into the future. This fact that there is a 007 because Bond has retired, this 007 is a woman. She's a woman of color and she, you know, kicks ass. She's really, really good. She's professional. She's high competition for Bond, but they also work together and they have this bit in Cuba where they're still competitors, but then towards the end of the film they are allies, and she is in a substantial part in the ending as well. So what do you make of this? Because that is tied to that future of Bond, maybe future 007 movies with a different type of agent. Did that work out for you?
Absolutely. I was really, really happy. I mean, apart from the love story, which I don't think works, they don't get the chemistry quite right. But the other girls, Ana de Armas and Lashana Lynch, were just fabulous. They were really kick-ass ladies. I sort of love the bit where you have the bedroom scene and she takes off her wig and Bond says, okay, that wasn't the first thing I thought you'd take off. And apart from that being a nice little, you know, self-referential wink, is that normally Bond and her would end up in bed together, which of course they don't. It's also a link to, which one was it?
Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die, exactly.
Agent Rosie Carver taking off her wig, and she's a double agent, so that was a nice Easter egg there.
Clever, clever, clever. And I was sorry to see Ana de Armas go, because that scene was, I don't know, one of the many, many favorites I had in the first part of this movie, where she says, oh, I had a course of like 3 weeks, and she seems like the ingenue that we've seen so many times, that was really that inept agent. And then she's like, rocks the entire scene, and is absolutely awesome, and has the martini, and it's just, I really like the women in this. And this is just, this shows that they can do women well, have a little bit of self-mockery as a franchise and have it really work and still have Bond be suave, just a little bit funnier. And I thought that worked amazingly well. And I really hope they keep that dynamic, because it's just, I just thought it was grand. I had such fun.
I agree. And I think Phoebe Waller-Bridge's influence was really felt in this and in a lot of the dialogues, not just the dialogues of the, you know, female characters or between the female characters. But I think that bit was really, really successful for me too. And it was maybe Casino Royale was the other movie where I felt the dialogues were really on point. But this one was really strong as well. How about you, Alan? Did you feel the same about this bit?
I did. One of the strengths of this film is the supporting cast. And a very interesting thing I found out, I saw the new Wes Anderson film, The French Dispatch, recently, in pretty much the same week. And it's got the same actor who plays basically the mother of Bond's child is in that. And what was really striking is she's more objectified in the Wes Anderson film. And you wouldn't expect that with a Bond film. You'd expect Bond to be the one that most panders to ogling out of the two films. I think that was a really just strike, having seen them sort of very close to each other. You do have this notion, whereas what you are getting engaged by is her role in the story, and to some extent, what she means to Daniel Craig and how Daniel Craig emotes that. But yeah, no, I think across the board, the supporting cast were really strong. And I think when we talk about the future of the Bond films, I think an interesting thing is if they're talking reboot, Does that mean we're going to lose all of these people?
I hope not.
I want to keep them because this is the first time that really they really have it spot on, right? With these two ladies, but also with Q. Ben Whishaw is reliably fantastic in this. And you really don't want to lose these. It's like a really good book. You really don't want to lose those characters.
But no, we won't lose them, I think. Because remember with Pierce Brosnan and then the switch to Daniel Craig, they kept Judi Dench on board because she was such a successful choice of M. And it didn't make sense logically to keep her. So I'm pretty sure they're going to go down that route again.
I mean, it'll be interesting because you sort of, with Bond films, somehow get to expect the supporting characters. They fulfill a very simple function in each film. They're in there for this reason. One of them is to get cross at Bond for breaking the rules. Another is to give him the gadgets. Another is to sort of be a bit cheeky and sassy, but ultimately fall into bed with him. They have such assigned roles normally. Whereas I liked in this film, and especially in the first two thirds, they feel like they have got lives and they've got jobs. And that is very sort of engaging. But if I do wonder whether if you sort of say, well, we're going to take all of them over to the next Bond film, but there's a new James Bond, whether that will simultaneously also be quite jarring, because none of them would be going, oh, well, we had a previous James Bond around here, and I was sad what happened to him. Why has this new person got the same name? So I wonder whether, you know, they'll just go, it is the end of an era. Because, again, if you want to treat these characters as real, you kind of have to take that seriously in the universe and not have them all turn up with a new James Bond and go, well, you know, we're all still the same. I mean, I think they could make it work, but I do wonder whether it would be quite confusing or whether they'll just go, right, let's have a clean slate. Let's start all over again.
Maybe there will be that portrait of Daniel Craig in that gallery where they had the other M's. Maybe that will be the way out.
The M. No, but in a way, I was sort of hopeful that they gave Q a little private life scene where he's preparing dinner and he has a cat, cutest cat, and I was like, we get a little bit of insight into Q, and I'm like, why bother if you're not going to keep him, right? I was sort of hopeful. I was like, they're giving him this charming little scene in his beautiful apartment with his cat and his date about to arrive, and here's Bond barging in. Why bother if they're not going to keep him? So, and I love Ben Whishaw, obviously, because he's absolutely marvelous.
I think what will be interesting with Bond is just that they don't have any prediction. I mean, this was a prime example when the next Bond is going to come out. It used to be that 2-year gap, normally 3 years maybe. And now, of course, so many things change in between. Actors will not or don't want to play these characters anymore. Things that change, scripts that get postponed. So it's not like you put out a Netflix series and then the next year you can keep the cast. So Bond is much more eclectic, and I think it's interesting that they still were able to create the universe in these 15 years of Daniel Craig and somehow make it seem coherent, but just the production history is so different from actual film series.
But it sets up, I think, with the Daniel Craig series, one of the things, having been rewatching it a little bit just in preparation for this film, is I think it suffers a little bit from they clearly sort of wanted an arc, but they never sort of wholeheartedly went in for it. So they're trying to fit an arc into sometimes the formula of what they think a Bond film should be. And I think it's quite interesting that you have the first couple of Daniel Craig Bond films are almost really trying not to reference back. They really feel like they're being a clean slate. And then you get to Skyfall and it's just like, look at all these Easter eggs.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really make sense if you're thinking that Daniel Craig's Bond only really became 007 two films ago. You're chasing a nostalgia that you're now also saying isn't associated with this character. Like, why is he interested in a car that we saw Roger Moore or Sean Connery drive? Because we're now looking at it as someone distinct. If they're restarting things, I wonder whether that will be the time to go, right, we're now going to plan it. We're going to sign someone who agrees to make, say, 4 or 5 films. Those 4 or 5 films will be planned around this story that will begin with him, I don't know, becoming 007 and end with possibly their death or something. And it will be far more, and we're going to tell that, you know, that the link is always given us, I guess, with the Bourne films, that you really give them their own internal narrative that will, to some extent, run across films in their own universe that's set up to tell a certain story. And so you sort of embrace that to tell an arc that they sort of partly tried to get to with Daniel Craig, but I think often we're just that little bit conservative of thinking, yeah, but it's a Bond film, so we need to have this. We need to have these elements. And I do wonder, especially coming out of this, that what seems to have got the best feedback is the stuff that's relatively new rather than the Volcano Lair stuff. So whether that finally means they can go, yeah, we're not going to do that again.
Firstly, I'm probably one of the very few, but I really did not like Skyfall. I didn't think that was appropriate. I didn't think it was impactful, and I didn't think it was charming. I did with this one because it was more sensitively done with a car, with the music and the pre-credit sequence referencing All Your Majesty's Secret Service. But I was wondering, as we have you here, Sam, there's been gossip knocking about having a young Bond, like having a pre-Bond Bond. So almost like with Casino Royale, we went back in time in terms of the books. And then Alan rightly says they couldn't let it go and sort of put all the junk back in. But I think that story's been knocking about a bit, that they might do a very young Bond, like, I don't know, a young Indiana Jones, perhaps. I don't know. Do you know anything about this, Sam? And would it be a good idea if you did?
Personally, I don't think it would be a good idea, but I know that that the rumor's been around. There's also a young Bond series of novels that has already come out, but I'm not sure if they have the rights, the possibilities, or the willingness to go into these and film these. But I'm sure they're looking at the option, because I personally think a reboot with a new person coming in and with no reference to Daniel Craig as James Bond will make the most sense in a few years if they do it cleverly. I am still in the camp of hoping that they will just have an independent James Bond adventure that is not going to be related to the next one and the next one and the next one. Even though, Alan, I agree with you that if they went down that road, they would have to plan it. Obviously, with Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, that was kind of planned that that would be the sequel of Casino Royale because that was so successful. And then it seemed like this was the ending of these plot elements that were now over. He's now over taking revenge for Vesper Lynn's death. And then Skyfall seemed to be a standalone Bond film in a way, but they didn't really manage that. Then Spectre came, and of course you had to tie up the loose ends there. So it's all really confusing. So I wasn't too happy with some of the seriality of that, even though I loved Casino Royale as the beginning of Bond. So I would just be happy with a new Bond actor, same age roughly as the other actors have been in the past. If they want to do a reboot, maybe bring him in again into the role in a clever way. Don't dwell on it for too long, but give him an assignment, give him stuff to do, have scenes like the ones we saw in Matera, Italy, in Cuba, you know, great action scenes, but also independent scenes that in the style of Bond, it will make the audiences happy. And I just think people will be happy going and watching it. Even as a Bond fan, I don't hope for long Bond stories that take 10, 15 years to develop. I don't think that's an ideal future for Bond.
I mean, I guess the two of you being Bond fans, you're the people I should ask this question. So is this a hankering for what I would almost say like pantomime, that you have the sort of megalomaniac villain in their lair and the film is building up to the defeat of that? Because I think we got off this earlier, but the villain in this is really bad. And I think the presentation of the villain with the facial disfigurement, I think, is so lazy. It feels like another era. It feels like something from the past. And in terms of what you want from Bond going forward, how do you sort of keep it fresh? How would you like to keep it fresh in terms of being traditionally Bond, but not having these very lazy tropes?
Well, I think they could take a leaf out of the book of the MCU and do basically, between quotes, a spin-off Bond. There's a difference between having kind of a monster of the week or having a movie where there's one plot which has a head and a tail and is just a Bond movie in itself, and having a lazy villain with this really strange, visible sort of visible difference in his face that's not necessary, that's lazy, that's just ableist yuck. And having a Bond spin-off film with a good, nice, nasty villain who chews the scenery and is really happy to be bad, and have that as a one, as a contained film, instead of having these really long arcs. Because if this is another 15 years for an arc, I will be like 60 by the time the arc ends. I mean, it's just not, well, not quite 60, but it's just not, I don't think it's quite viable to have these arcs run that long in real time. So I would like to have a Bond film that has a head and a tail and is a self-contained thing, And maybe it has an adult Bond or a somewhat younger Bond. It doesn't really matter because it's just a spin-off within that sort of universe. And I do hope they don't lean on all sorts of tropes from 100 years ago because they're getting old. So I think in answer to your question, Alan, a little bit of both.
To me personally, the most successful Bonds were always the ones, and they were sometimes self-contained, sometimes they weren't, was when they were partly going back to original ideas, plot elements that hadn't used, for instance, from Ian Fleming yet, but they were able to develop it into something that was rather unexpected and that was leaving out some of the typical elements, especially the final bit that we mentioned now a couple of times. If I think of License to Kill, Honor Match Secret Service, some of my favorite Bonds, even Casino Royale, they went down a different road and it was really successful. And I think No Time to Die has elements of that, minus the island layer at the end and the villain bit. It, of course, had unexpected parts until very late in the film, and it ended on a very unexpected note, as we've said. So I think it will be finding a good balance between unused elements that are still Bondian or that cleverly reference old Bonds without just being rehashed, and Easter eggs that are too obvious, like for instance in Die Another Day, that was an unsuccessful example of that. And then updating it, keeping it fresh, and keeping audiences on the edge of their seat in terms of what they can expect. And I think that's why No Time to Die worked for me so well, because to a large extent, they were really successful at that.
And we can keep the Aston Martin DB5, right? Right?
Yes, let's keep that one. I totally agree. That also maybe gives us a chance to think of who's in the running for being the next Bond, because there's always the rumor mill that keeps on spinning. And of course, it's too early to tell, but maybe you've heard, maybe you've seen people, read about people that are potential Bonds in the future. Barbara Broccoli famously came out and said it's going to be a man. James Bond is not going to be a woman, but otherwise they're completely open to all the options. So do you have any favorites? Have you read any about any likelies, and do you like them or not?
I mean, I always go for the default answer that I don't want to be able to predict who gets cast next. That's my default for Doctor Who. That's going to be my default for Bond. I think it's quite interesting with Bond that when you look at the media, they always seem to be casting the Bond for about 10 years ago. All the names do seem a bit old because it's people they've seen in Bond-style roles or seen being suave or an action hero. But in films that have already been made, they've already been hugely successful. They've already sort of reached the sort of general public consciousness. And often by that point, they're getting on a bit. So as part of the conversation, you're thinking, well, you're looking at a man in their 50s. And I do think maybe it should be someone in their early 20s, maybe late 20s, go quite young as a new agent, cocky new agent who kicks against the boss, kicks against, you know, sort of established proper behavior. And I don't know who you'd cast for that. You would want to be looking at who's in theater now, who maybe has done a film that people haven't watched, and sort of go down that route. And then if you're convinced they've got talent, like surprise the world and say, we've got this kid, we think you will really like this person to play Bond. Especially, I think, if you're doing a bit of a reboot and you maybe don't want this Bond to just fit the absolute sort of cliche understanding of Bond. It's not just going to be someone who's going to quip, raise an eyebrow and bed a woman. That you might want them to have a bit more to do, in which case we're picking, you know, actors could be picked that fit the Bond that worked previously but might not fit the Bond that they want to tell a story for. But I mean, this is my cop-out way of saying I don't know.
I think Tom Hardy has been named. Well, a lot of people have been named, but Tom Hardy is one. And I think that is the problem with him is not that he's not lovely, but it's exactly what you say, Alan. We've seen a lot of him. We have an idea about what kind of a character he is. And I think that might very well be a handicap for a reboot. I mean, the strength of casting Craig was that he was not at all Bond-like. And I think that's exactly, like you say, that is what we should be going for. Whether he'd be 40 or 20 or 25 or 30, I really don't care. But somebody a little bit from left field. I mean, as Bond is a very conservative franchise in its core, in its DNA, it's a very conservative worldview and it's a very conservative franchise. It could use a little bit of sprucing up in that sense, I think.
I mean, I think we've just in terms of Daniel Craig, I mean, we've talked about how he was, I think, very well regarded as an actor. But I think there was something very interesting when he first sort of appeared in Casino Royale. It's very much sort of walking out the ocean in the smallest of swimming trunks. I think that's underestimated how much that reframed Bond, because before that, I think there was a lot of the popular imagination of Bond was the idea that he was, his view of sex was kind of purely comic. It was a world of innuendos. The women would be sexy. He might be good looking, but he was not to be ogled in quite the way Daniel Craig is and is presented in the film. It was very much a sort of conservative and I think quite a British view of sex as sort of carry-on film, innuendo, let's joke about it, but for goodness sake, don't show it to us.
And on he comes being Honey Rider, basically, yeah. Because that's the reference. That's gutsy.
But it's a representing Bond, that sex in Bond includes a very sexy Bond and not a comedy Roger Moore Bond, which I think is still, to some extent, a lot of the popular imagination of the character. So suddenly for Bond to be part of the sexual attraction of the series, I think, was something that they sort of quite deliberately did well with Craig. And whether that's something they would want to carry on and just have someone who is, to some extent, to be ogled and appreciated.
And I must say, they are quite clever at really finding the person that fits the age in which the movies come out. And I have pretty big confidence that they will be able to pull that off again. The Bond producers at the moment, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, they are still very much in control of that casting process and of defining the direction that the Bond series is going to take. I'm wondering a little bit how long that will last, because of course Amazon has taken over control or production of the future Bond films and also will make or try to make decisions about maybe spin-offs or Bond series, other products that might come out under the label of Bond, just as has happened with Star Wars and Disney. But I do have confidence that they will be able to define quite clearly and say, we want Bond to go into that direction. This should be the future actor to play James Bond. As you said, who could have predicted Daniel Craig before 2005? I don't think anyone would have guessed. They would have gone for much more obvious choices. And this time, I also don't think it will be Tom Hiddleston or it'll be Tom Hardy or it will be Henry Cavill. Those are all the names that have been around. I don't think it will be that kind of an obvious choice. I think a name will pop up. Probably the press will pick up. The Sun will pick up on a couple of names in the casting process. Maybe they will try to guess at it. But I have good confidence in them that they will bring the Bond for the 2020s. And he will fit as well as Pierce Brosnan did for the 90s and as Daniel Craig now did for the past 15 years.
It does, I think, raise an interesting question whether killing off Bond in this film has freed them a bit more with recasting, simply because it is going to have to be, to some extent, this is a brand new James Bond. This isn't the guy you saw in the last few films. We're restarting things. And then I think that opens the idea that it is a non-one, that you're having someone who, it's a recreation of the character. And they would say, you know, this is for their own set of films, their own take on James Bond. We're not asking you to take a non-white actor and say, well, it's a continuation of the story that Sean Connery was in, and Roger Moore was in. I think whether killing this Bond off and then saying there will be a new James Bond, the fact that it's new frees them up even more when it comes to casting to say, well, we can recreate the character. And I do wonder whether, I mean, that would be the bold step to not pander to conservatism, would be to have a black James Bond, and whether they've set themselves up for it by basically killing off a Bond. I think that's going to be interesting where they go from here.
Well, you're a man after my own heart, because you know, of course, that I've been clamoring for Idris Elba for like years as the new Bond. I was like, well, when's going to be his time? He's perfect. And they didn't want to go for it because I think their audience is mainly conservative also. But as you say, maybe this gives them a little bit of leeway for having Bond from Hong Kong. Who knows? Or from Japan or from, you know, the southern states. I don't know.
And not wanting to give them, I don't know, an excuse to placate conservatives, but they could still turn around and go, yeah, well, I mean, this will be the Bond for the next couple of films, but he will be replaced with another Bond. So whether they could just sort of say, well, put up with this, but you might get your white British guy a bit down the line, because, you know, it can change like this. And I think killing Bond has set that up.
Killing Bond and also introducing Lashana Lynch as a potential 007. I think that really opened up the space of possibilities, like you said, and I think it will be really interesting. I think it's wonderful to see that towards the end of our podcast, how we are engaging in that question. But we know that outside of our podcast, of course, thousands of people are also engaging in that question. If you talk to anyone, even if they're not big Bond fans, even if they haven't seen the film or many of the films, but this question of who will be the next Bond and who should be it, what would be a suitable choice, that's ongoing. And I think that's so clever about the Bond series. It's something that everybody engages in to some extent, even if you're not a fan. I mean, Alan, you're prime example today. Even if you're not a big Bond fan, to the very big Bond fans, it's a conversation. And I think it's across generations, it's across cultures. And that's why discussing Bond is so enjoyable with a new film or just in general.
I can remember as a kid in the playground, it was sort of talked about that this big theory that James Bond itself was a code. And this was an explanation for why he looked so different. Was, you know, these different people, it wasn't the same person. Someone else becomes James Bond. It's almost like 007. You become the agent. And that was sort of an explanation. And I remember it being talked about that one of the films, maybe one day the films would actually set that out completely. They would, someone would, they'd recast it. And they, in the first film, they'd sort of become the new James Bond because the villains of the world need to fear a James Bond. So let's keep one alive, whoever it actually turns out to be.
I have the same. I know that fan theory too, Alan, yeah.
But it's interesting that it went beyond, it's like what Sam says, I think, that it goes beyond being a fan theory. It's the stuff that's still just generally talked about. I mean, this was in the playground. This was at school when I think Timothy Dalton was coming in as Bond. And, you know, we knew Roger Moore, we knew Sean Connery from on telly. So you had this idea as how is this the same person but different? And, yeah, just in the general population, how that works is discussed, which I think is... Not many mainstream franchises have that much detail in the public consciousness.
And especially because now these children, you know, who were in the playground, they're now making YouTube videos and they're now recording podcasts. So this so-called codename theory, which really does exist among Bond fans, it's heavily discussed, of course, at the moment. Yeah, is ongoing. It has moved on from something that children discussed up until, you know, seniors are discussing across generations. So is that the moment to wrap things up and bring this to a close?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've successfully completed our mission for this recording.
I think we have. So thank you very much, Julie and Alan, for being part of our Bond discussion. Another one. I hope, of course, in the future there will be more to discuss in the world of Bond, and I'm pretty sure about that. So thanks to our listeners as well, and join us next time for A Damn Fine Cup of Culture.
Bye.
Bye-bye.